sector. We had the mass. You can take them to be the mass of the Higgs, mh. Or you could take it to be mu, which we wrote down. So they're related by mh squared is equal to 2 mu squared. And then there's also the quartic coupling, lambda. And in terms of these parameters, you can also derive mw, mz, and also the Higgs-Vev. So those are not free parameters. They're fixed once you specify certain things, in particular mu squared, lambda, and g and g prime. You can compute these things. All right. And then we have 9 fermion masses. So we have me, mu, m tau for the charged leptons. And then we have the up-type quarks, mu, mc, mt, and then the down-type quarks, md, ms, and mb. And then we have parameters for the CKM matrix element, matrix elements. Did you guys figure out how many parameters there are?
Four?
That's right, there's 4. So that's it. Those are all of the parameters that we discussed so far. There's actually one more which we haven't discussed, so I'll just put that in parentheses. So there's also an additional parameter. Which is called theta QCD. And what that is I can actually write down an extra term in the standard model Lagrangian, which I didn't discuss at all. That extra term is takes the following form, epsilon mu nu alpha beta, and then the gluon field strain tensor, g mu nu g alpha beta, like this. I didn't write it down, but I could have written it down. And the coefficient of this operator is a parameter theta QCD. The reason why I didn't write it down or discuss it is because, as far as we can tell, theta QCD seems to be very close to 0. Current limits are that it has to be smaller than around 10 to the minus 10. So for whatever reason, this term just seems to be absent from the standard model, though we don't understand exactly why. So as far as we can tell, theta QCD seems to be very close to 0. All right. So those are the parameters of the standard model. There are some things which I could have written down. If we had included neutrino masses, there would be extra parameters for the neutrino mass sector. But for the standard model with massless neutrinos, these are all the parameters that we have. There's, 5 plus 9 is 14, plus 4 is 18, I think. Is that right? And then we have theta QCD, so then there's 19 parameters total. Is my math right? I hope so. So that's it. Standard model doesn't explain what those parameters are, just says that they're there, and then you go to data to try to fit them. All right.
Why don't we extend the standard model by adding neutrino mass? Like we know there is a mass, so why don't we just add the mass of neutrino?
Yeah, I'll talk about neutrino masses next week. But the reason is, which I mentioned very briefly last week, we don't know what kind of mass term to write down, and there's 2 choices for what we can do. We could have written a Dirac mass term, very similar to what we did for the charged leptons and the quarks, just by adding in a right-handed neutrino field. But that's not the only choice you can make. You can actually generate Majorana masses without introducing right-handed neutrino fields. So there's a choice of 2 different things, and we just don't know at this point which one's right.
Why is there no,
Yeah, so the one for QCD is kind of unique because the ones for the other gauge fields end up rotating these terms away. So yeah, you can actually get rid of those terms by just making effectively a redefinition of the fields. But for the QCD terms, you can't. All right. Any other questions on these parameters? All right. So in principle, you could compute everything you wanted to know in terms of these 19 parameters. And that's why the standard model is so predictive, because there's hundreds of different observables. And they're all determined in terms of a limited set of parameters, although there's 19. It would be nice if there was only one parameter, but that's not the theory we have. Next, I'm going to change gears and talk about kind of a new topic. Just start over here. And this goes under the name of deep inelastic scattering. Which is often abbreviated as DIS. So the standard model has quarks, and quarks are all bound together into hadrons. So we have hadrons that are made from quarks. But you might ask, you know, how do we know this? The only states that we have to play with are hadrons. There's no such thing as a free quark that you can measure and test experimentally. You can't unbind a free quark from a hadron. When you try to put more and more energy into a hadron to try to separate one of the quarks out, all you end up getting are just more hadrons. So let me explain how that works. Let's say you have, consider an electron beam scattering on a proton. So I draw it like this. We have an electron beam, electron in, electron out, and it scatters by exchanging a photon. And let me draw the proton very schematically, just as a UUD, like this. And let's say we want to separate out the U quark by hitting it really hard with this virtual photon. And it gets kicked like this. So the U quark goes that way, and the other quarks go this way. But of course, it doesn't separate out the U quark from the other two, because it takes more and more energy to move this quark farther and farther away from its partners. It becomes energetically favorable just to create a QQ bar pair out of the vacuum. So what happens is you'll end up with a U here and a U and D here, but you end up just popping out of the vacuum, let's say, a D bar and a D, like this. So I haven't created a free quark. I've just created a meson and, let's say, a neutron. And well, if this Q has still more energy, then it could be separated from this D bar like this. And the D bar might go like that. And then again, you'll just pop out another pair from the vacuum. Let's say it's a U bar and a U. So I've made, again, not a free quark, but just more hadrons. So here I have a neutron and then two mesons. All right. So the reason it works like this is just because it's energetically favorable. To create QQ bar pairs compared to separating a free quark. So, and this idea is called confinement. That it takes an infinite amount of energy to separate off a free quark, and so there's no such thing. So I also want to mention this process where the U quark gets hit and then it gets spit off, and it creates all of these other hadronic states is a process called fragmentation or hadronization. Okay, so the process of hadronization results from the fact that the beta function of QCD is negative. And with a Landau pole, at a scale theta lambda QCD, which is around 200 MeV. So if I plotted the coupling constant, I've drawn this plot for you before, but if you plot the coupling constant alpha S for the strong interaction, which is just GS squared over 4 pi, as a function of energy, so energy is increasing this way, the coupling constant looks something like this. And it blows up at a particular place, at a particular energy scale, which is lambda QCD. Or in terms of distance, I can think of distance as getting smaller and smaller this way. Distance is getting smaller and smaller this way, corresponding to larger and larger energies. And so distance increasing would be to the left. So energy is increasing to the right, and distance is increasing to the left. If you've never calculated the beta function for QCD, I definitely recommend it. You can look up how to do it in chapter 16 in Peskin and Schroeder. You can just follow along. And after you finish, you'll be a better person. All right. So why do we get hadronization occurring? It happens because the beta function is blowing up at a particular scale, lambda QCD. So hadronization is a non-perturbative effect that occurs when the coupling constant alpha s divided by 4 pi becomes 1. So in perturbation theory, higher order terms will always show up proportional to powers of alpha s over 4 pi. And so when this quantity becomes order 1, perturbation theory is breaking down. And that's exactly the process that leads to hadronization. So I can just look at where does this coupling become of order 1, and that sets the scale for where hadronization is occurring. It's just set by lambda QCD. So, so I can say the distance scale for hadronization to occur is around 1 over lambda QCD, so lambda QCD inverse. And so this is just 1 over 200 MeV, which in units of length, that turns to be around 1 femtometer. All right. So which is 10 to the minus 15 meters. OK. It's also no surprise that this is precisely about the radius of the proton, right? So exactly this effect is setting the radius of your hadrons, like the proton. All right.
Isn't that like the value for alpha, that alpha s over 4 pi equals 1 and alpha s diverges, it's very different?
No, they're not very different. It's, I mean, so maybe you're talking about here versus here, it's not a big difference. This is just supposed to be a twiddle. Okay. All right, so that's the story with hadronization. Now let's talk about what happens at small scales. So the flip side of confinement, which is why states hadronize, is asymptotic freedom. Which just means that at distances much, much less than this inverse lambda QCD, so much, much less than a femtometer, quarks behave as just free fermions. And perturbation theory applies. Because alpha s becomes much, much less than 1. So effectively, if I wanted to study free quarks, I don't have to separate one out from a hadron. I just have to look at a hadron on very small scales. So combining these two things, hadronization, which is due to confinement, and asymptotic freedom, implies a very important result, which goes under the name factorization. And here's what it means in words. It just means what happens at small distances. So much, much less than a femtometer isn't affected by the dynamics over large distances. Which is around a femtometer. And this is the reason why it is possible to make precision calculations involving hadrons at high energies. So for example, if you think about the LHC, you're combining proton and proton at very high energies, and you're producing stuff which is going to involve a lot of hadrons. So you might think, because I don't know anything about hadrons, because it's non-perturbative physics, I don't know anything about the initial states, I don't know anything about the final states, and so maybe you'd worry, perhaps it's hopeless to try to look for example, the Higgs boson, which is, you know, one rare event among, you know, trillions and trillions of hadronic collisions. So it's not the case because of factorization. Yeah, we'll get to that in a second. So before we see how factorization works, let's first consider the process that we started with, EP scattering, and we're just going to consider it in general, assuming we knew nothing about quarks. So let's consider all right. So here's the process we want to consider. We have an electron going in and electron going out. And it scatters through a photon. And then we have a proton going in. And a proton will have momentum p. And then what comes out after the photon hits the proton is a multitude of hadronic states. So I'll draw it like this. You might have state 1, state 2, state 3, dot, 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 all the way to state n. And I'll just call the final states some hadronic state H, which is comprised of multiple hadrons, 1, 2, 3, to n in the final state. So H is the final hadronic state. Okay. And let me label also these other momenta. You'll have L and L prime like this. And there's also Q will be the momentum of the photon, which is going in this direction. All right. And so there's two different cases you can think about. The simplest case would be, let's say the proton is not broken up. That's called elastic scattering. In this case, H is just equal to the proton. So the proton is not broken up. Or you can have inelastic scattering, which means you just get lots of stuff coming out. So H would be equal to multiple hadrons, 1, 2, to n. So here the proton is broken up. All right, so we have some momenta. So we have the electron. So we have L mu, which is the initial electron momentum. We have L prime mu, which is the final electron momentum. We have capital P mu, which is the proton momentum. I should say the initial proton. And then P prime mu is the sum over all of the final states, 1 to n. So I can write that as the sum, I 1 to n, P prime mu I is the sum of all hadronic states. Okay, and then we also have Q. Q is the photon momentum, which is just L mu minus L prime mu. We're also going to work in the limit where the electron beam has sufficient energy so that we can set the electron mass to zero. All right. So again, we don't really know anything about what this process is, how the photon turns a proton into all of these hadrons, but don't worry about that. Before we get there, let's define some kinematic variables. So there's four variables we have to introduce. One is called capital Q squared, and that's just minus little q squared. This is called the momentum transfer squared. Or just the momentum transfer. The reason why you define it like this is just because little q squared is always negative, and it's easy to see that by just expanding what little q squared is. It's just L minus L prime squared. So that's just equal to minus 2 L dot L prime, since we're neglecting the electron mass. And if I just plug in for these four vectors, I just get minus 2 E L prime 1 minus cosine theta where theta is the scattering angle. Of the outgoing electron. So 1 minus cosine theta is always positive, which means that q squared is always negative. So it's customary to define big Q squared such that it's always positive. All right. The next variable we want to introduce is called nu. So nu is equal to capital P dot Q divided by the mass of the proton. So that's just what it's defined as. What's the meaning of nu? Well, let's work in the rest frame. Of the initial proton. This is also known as the lab frame. So it's like I have some chunk of protons that's at rest in the laboratory, and I'm hitting it with my beam of electrons. That's why it's called the lab frame. So in this frame, P mu is just equal to MP 0, 0, 0. And now I can plug in to see what nu is in this frame. And it would just be equal to MP times EL minus EL prime. The difference of the incoming minus the outgoing electrons divided by MP. So the MPs cancel, and I'm just left with EL minus EL prime. So it's just the energy transfer in the lab frame. The next variable I want to introduce is called y, and it is p dot q divided by p dot l. So again, let's just compute what the meaning of this variable is in the rest frame of the initial proton, the lab frame. So in the lab frame, y is equal to mp times E L minus E L prime. And then the denominator will just be MP times E L. So the, again, the MPs cancel. I'll just get E L minus E L prime divided by E L. So it's the fractional energy transfer in the lab frame. It's just the energy transfer divided by the energy of the beam. The last variable I have is called x. X is defined as q squared divided by 2p dot q. So I have minus little q squared, so I can also rewrite this as big q squared times 2p dot q. Or I can use nu to rewrite p dot q using mp times nu. So I can also express this as q squared over 2 mp times nu. So those are all equivalent. This variable goes under the name Bjorkane x, since he was the first one to recognize the importance of this variable. So we'll see what this x means in a second. But I just want to make one point first. All of these four variables are defined in terms of Lorentz scalar products. So that means that no matter which frame you evaluate them in, they're always going to be the same. So you can evaluate them in the rest frame of the proton, or you can evaluate them in the center of mass frame. Doesn't matter. they're always going to be exactly the same. So all the variables are the same in any frame, since they're Lorentz invariant. That's right, yeah. So here, this applies only in the lab frame, these statements here. So that's one particular frame. But if I just compute that using the beam energy, the outgoing energy of the electron divided by the beam energy, that quantity y will be invariant. And so now if I go to a different frame, it's exactly the same value of y. So this applies only in the lab frame, this expression. And also this expression here is only in the lab frame. But when I write it in terms of the Lorentz four products, scalar products, that's invariant. Okay, so let's see what the meaning of this x variable is. And to start with, let's consider just elastic scattering. Okay. To see the meaning of x, we want to consider elastic scattering. All right. So let's write down the following expression. P prime squared. Now, for the case of elastic scattering, P prime is just the momentum of the outgoing proton. Since elastic scattering, I have a proton going into a proton. So P prime squared will just be equal to MP squared. This is where H is just equal to the proton. Now I can also use momentum conservation to write P prime as P plus L minus L prime, which I can write as Q. So this is just from momentum conservation. And now I can expand this as P squared plus 2 p dot q plus q squared. And this p squared, again, is mp squared. So I have plus 2 p dot q plus q squared. So now I can cancel from both sides the mp squared. And I just get the following expression. Right, I get that minus q squared is equal to 2 p dot q. Or I can write it as 2 minus q squared over 2 p dot q is equal to 1. So that was just x, right? X was defined as this. And so x is equal to 1 for elastic scattering. So now let's do inelastic scattering. So let's do exactly the same calculation. We have p prime squared. So now I have more than one state in the final state. So I have to sum from I equals 1 to n. I have p prime 1 plus p. Oh, wait, I'm doing a sum, so I'll just write it like this. So now when I take the square, you can imagine you'll get terms that will be like p prime 1 dot p prime 1. And you'll also get cross terms like p prime 1 dot p prime 2. So you'll get terms like this, where you just have the masses. And then you'll also have plus the cross terms. like 2 p prime 1 dot p prime 2, et cetera, like this. All right. And the only point I want to make is that because you're involving many, many hadrons in the final state, and you have to sum over all of their masses, then it's definitely true that this right-hand side has to be greater than the proton mass squared. Since, yeah, so this has to be greater than the proton mass squared. All right, so now let's go through the same argument that we did up here. We have p prime squared minus mp squared would just be 2p dot q plus q squared. And all of this has to be greater than 0. Now, I can also express this in terms of x. I have 2p dot q, 1 minus x, substituting in x for q squared over 2p dot q. So this whole thing also has to be greater than 0. Now, this quantity here, 2 times p dot q, also is greater than 0 because nu, which was up top behind this other board, nu is also greater than 0. It's the energy transfer. You can't have a negative energy transfer. So this part here is greater than 0. So this one here also has to be greater than 0. So putting this together, x has to be less than 1. We can get a lower limit on x just by remembering that it's in the numerator of x is q squared. Q squared, again, is always positive. Big Q squared is always positive. So x can't be less than 0. So it has to be this. So this is the allowed range for inelastic scattering. So to summarize, for elastic scattering, x is equal to 1. For inelastic scattering, x can be between 0 and 1. So this parameter x, in a sense, measures whether you're inelastic or elastic. All right, so those are the kinematic variables that we're going to worry about and deal with. And now we're going to compute this cross-section for scattering off of the proton. I just want to remind you one small fact. So just remember, when you have 2-to-2 scattering, you know how many independent kinematic variables you have. There's only one, essentially. For 2-to-2 scattering, the differential cross-section d sigma by d cosine theta only has one independent kinematic variable. Which you can take to be, for example, cosine theta, or you can take it to be the Mandelstam parameter t. Either of those will work. Of course, they're related to one another. This is in addition to the center of mass energy. So in addition to the total center of mass energy, squared, which is S. Is that right? Is that a familiar fact? So when you compute 2-to-2 scattering, you know there's Mandelstam variables S, T, and U. They're not all independent, right? There's a relation that you can express U in terms of S and T. So the only point I'm making is that In general, you have two parameters. One is just the total center of mass energy, which is just fixed, let's say, by your beam energy. But the other one is independent, and it depends. So you can take that to be T. Or you could take it to be the scattering angle, cosine theta. So all I'm saying is the differential cross-section, once you fix the beam energy, just has one independent kinematic variable for 2-to-2 scattering. So that would be the case for elastic scattering. It would be exactly the same. So for in elastic scattering, I should say for elastic scattering, it is 2-to-2 scattering. So we have one independent kinematic variable. And you can take that to be anything you like. It could be the scattering angle, cosine theta, or it could be one of the variables we defined. It could be q squared, it could be y, or it could be nu. Or it could be t. So any of those would be fine. But they're not independent from one another. If you knew one, then you can solve for what each of them is. That's the only point I'm trying to make. And you have this one independent kinematic variable in addition to the total center of mass energy. So in addition to S. All right. But now, for inelastic scattering, it's no longer true. We have two independent variables. So you can take one of them to be cosine theta, q squared, y, nu, or t, whichever one you like. But there's one other variable, which is x, right? You need also x, since x is not fixed to be 1 anymore. So I should say either one of these and x. And then in addition to the center of mass energy, S. So once you fix the beam energy, you fixed S. There's two independent parameters. Any of these are related to one another, but then you also have to specify X as well. That's all. OK. So now let's compute the cross-section. And what I'm going to do is compute not just the cross-section to one particular hadronic final state, where we have specific hadrons in the final state. I'm going to actually just sum over all possible hadrons in the final state. So this is called inclusive scattering. So sum over all hadrons in the final state. So what that means is I'm going to write that as the cross-section for electron, proton, to go to electron, and then x. X just means any and all hadrons in the final state are allowed. So that's the sum over all the specific hadronic states, h, of all of the cross-sections to produce H. So this is a specific cross-section to produce a given final state H, and now I'm computing the inclusive cross-section, which is just summing over all possibilities. Okay. So lastly, I just want to mention we're going to work in the deep inelastic regime. That just means that the beam energy and the energy transfer are going to be really, really large compared to the proton mass. So let's say the square root center, the center of mass energy, which is just the square root of S, and then and also the energy transfer will be much, much larger than the mass of the proton. So that just means the beam energy is going to be really large, and most of the time the proton is just going to be fragmented and broken up inelastically. All right. So now let's write down what the cross section is. So we want this inclusive cross section. We have to sum over H. And do I still have the diagram up? I don't think I do. So I'll just draw it again. So I have proton, electron, electron going out, and I have p prime 1, p prime 2, p prime n. All right, so let's write down the cross section. So first we have 1 over 2 times the energy of the electron and 2 times the energy of the proton, and then the relative velocity, magnitude of that. And now we integrate over the final state momenta. So I have d3l prime divided by 2 pi cubed, 1 over 2 el prime. And now we have lots of final state momenta to consider because we have to integrate over all of these as well, right? So we want to do a product. So I'll write that as pi, I equals 1 to n. Of all of these integrals, d3 p prime I over 2 pi cubed 1 over 2 e p prime I. Now we need momentum conservation. So that would be times 2 pi to the fourth delta 4 l plus p minus L prime minus sum over all these final state momenta, PI. And now we have the matrix element squared, and then averaged over spins. Averaged over initial spins, summed over final spins. Like this. Okay, so this is just the usual expression for the cross section. But now we want to figure out what's the matrix element for this process. So let's write that down. So that's I times the matrix element. So now we can do the lepton part pretty easily, right? We just use the rules of QED. We have a U bar spinner for L prime. Then we have an I e gamma mu, and then a u of l. So that's just the lepton part of the diagram. Now we have the photon propagator, which is just minus I over q squared. Now we have the hadron part. And again, we don't know how to do this. So we're just going to parameterize it as just a matrix element. So what we want to do is we want something that connects an outgoing state h to an initial state p. And we know to get there, we have to insert the operator that the photon is coupled to, which is just the electromagnetic current operator. So I can just write that as I, E, J, electromagnetic, and then a mu here. Because I know this is the only operator that couples to the photon. And I have to insert it between these two states to get something out, which is what I want. So the electromagnetic current is just equal to the sum over quarks, the quark charge, and then the quark fields, Q bar, gamma mu, Q. So this is what the photon field is coupled to. And again, I don't know what this matrix element is. And it depends on hadronization. What it means is I'm inserting some operator, and it converts a proton into a whole mess of different hadrons. That is hadronization, and I don't know how to compute that because it's non-perturbative physics. But even if we don't know that, let's continue on.
How did you write down the gain medium?
How can I write this? Well, so I know that I have the photon that connects. I have to write down a photon which couples these two points here, right? And the photon only couples to this particular operator in the Lagrangian. And so it's this operator that I want to compute the matrix element. It's a transition matrix element from the proton to this hadronic final state. But it has to be due to this operator because that's the only thing that AMU couples to. Is that clear? Okay. So all right, so let's just plug that in. So let's square this matrix element. I have 1/4 matrix element squared is e to the 4th over q to the 4th, right? And now I have 1/4. And the lepton part just gives me the trace of L/prime gamma mu L/gamma nu. But then the hadronic part will give me this thing squared. So I have hj electromagnetic mu proton times the complex conjugate pj electromagnetic with a nu and then h. Here I've only summed over the spins of the leptons. I still have to sum over the spins for the hadronic stuff. I'm averaging over the spins of the proton, and I'm summing over whatever hadron spins I have in the final state. So I'll just write that like this. OK. And again, we don't know what these things are. And we're not going to need to know what they are. So let's just plug that into the formula we have for the cross section. So I have sigma EP goes to E anything. And I'm going to rewrite it in a kind of a nice way. So let me first write certain terms, and then I'll write other terms. So we have a 2 EL times the magnitude of V, relative velocity. Now I'll integrate over the lepton momentum, E3L prime over 2 pi cubed, 1 over 2 EL prime. Now I'll pull out the factor of E to the 4th over Q to the 4th. And then I'll pull out this trace here as well with a factor of a half. So I'll have 1/2 times the trace of L/prime gamma mu L/gamma nu. So I've picked out certain terms, and now let me write down the other terms. So I have 1 over 2 EP. I still have to sum over H, so I'm summing over all final states H. I have to integrate over all of the final state momenta for the hadronic states. So I have all of these momentum integrals, d3p prime I over 2 pi to the fourth divided by, 2 pi cubed, sorry, over 1 over 2 epi prime. Then I have momentum conservation, which it should be 2 pi to the fourth delta 4, but let me just write 2 pi cubed times delta to the 4 of L plus P minus L prime minus sum over P prime I. So I'm missing a 2 pi, and it's just a matter of convention that you factor out one factor of 2 pi out front. Don't ask me why, but that's just what people do. And then lastly, we have all of this stuff here, which we don't know how to compute at all. So that's 1 half, because we only had one, we had a 1 fourth here, and I have a 1 half times another 1 half to make that 1 fourth. We're summing over all of the spins for the hadronic stuff. And then I have H electromagnetic mu P, and then P J electromagnetic nu H. All right. So you might notice the stuff on the top we like, right? We know how to compute that stuff. Stuff at the bottom we don't really like because it's kind of complicated and we don't even know how to compute some of these matrix elements. So what we're going to do is just define a quantity which is just all of this stuff on the second line. And it's just going to be called a two-index object, W mu nu, since I have to have two Lorentz indices, mu and nu here. So I'm just defining that to be W mu nu, like this. So, okay. So we're absorbing all of this hadronic physics, which is very complicated, into some object W mu nu, which, again, we don't know how to compute it. And then we're also going to define a leptonic tensor, which we do know how to compute. So that leptonic tensor will be L mu nu, which is just this stuff here, or I should say this stuff here, will be L mu nu, 1 half trace of L slash prime gamma mu L gamma nu. So that's not too complicated. We can compute this, right, using the rules we have for computing a trace. It's just a 2 times L mu L prime nu plus L nu L prime mu minus L dot L prime eta mu nu. So that's all. And now we can rewrite this cross section in a simpler form, which is just EP goes to EX is just all of this stuff here. So I have a 2 pi over 2 EL V rel. I have the integral d3L prime over 2 pi cubed, 1 over 2 EL prime. I have e to the fourth over q to the fourth. And then I just have L mu nu, W mu nu. So now the expression is a lot simpler. Well, I'm out of time, so we'll pick up here on well, later this afternoon. Yep. So all possible states that you could have that are hadronic in the final state. So a neutron in 2 mesons, a neutron in 17 mesons, 5 protons, 4 antiprotons, and 23 mesons, anything you can think of. You have to have the same number of baryons in the initial state as in the final state. But other than that, anything goes, basically. Yeah?
This matrix element, the q squared, is the momentum transfer, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And then the j and the q, those are the sum over 4.
Yep, that's, wait. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so this is just a sum over the different quark fields. That's right. Any other questions? Let me just mention, perhaps this could be useful. So I know there's a lot of steps to go through, and we're only partway done. What we're going to do is we'll show, even though we don't know what this tensor W mu nu is, we'll be able to parameterize it in terms of two functions. And each of those two functions will depend on the two independent kinematic variables we had. Right? I argued that you should have two independent kinematic variables. These functions composing W mu nu will also depend on those kinematic variables. And that's just what we'll have for the general case of electron-proton scattering. Now, when we get to, then the next thing we'll do is we'll consider what happens when you consider scattering off of quarks. So what does factorization tell us about what this function should look like? And it turns out that it implies some non-trivial properties for this function, which has been verified for the data, which verified by data, which tells us that there are quarks composing these objects. That's where we're headed.